I used a, for the first time in my life, I was forced to use an Apple. I found them awful hard to use. Didn't know what to do. They got their icons on the wrong side, first place. Anyway, evidence for the existence of God. Then when I get all finished, we'll have some time for questions. If you don't have any, I have lots of questions. And if you don't answer my questions, I was also in the United States Marine Corps. We love to watch people do push-ups. Okay, just so I let you know that. I have a style of teaching, which I think is the best style of teaching anywhere, called fear and intimidation. Works well. How many teachers here? Doesn't that work well? Yeah. Anyway, evidence for the existence of God. I'd like to start with our premise. Our premise is this, right out of Romans. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them. Notice that it is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So they were without excuse. In other words, God tells us there's no such thing as a real atheist here. Because in everybody's heart of hearts, they know there's a God because God put it there. And he says, you do not have an excuse. So all those people that are dead standing before God someday will say, well, God, I didn't know. He'll say, yes, you did. You willfully chose to reject me. So that's our premise. There's no such thing as a real atheist. There's actually five different evidences I like to do. One is cosmological, evidence from design, incredible design in all living things. The existence of non-material entities. We can prove that non-material things do exist, which ruins the whole foundation of evolutionism right there. The reality of God's word is a very powerful one. Then the moral argument, right and wrong. The two we're going to do tonight are the cosmological evidence, where did the universe come from, and the moral argument. Where do morals come from? Or is there really a right and wrong, and who decides? Why do bad things still happen if God is good? So that's what we'll cover. Now, atheism, there are arguments. The strongest argument for atheism is the problem of evil. It's strong because they think it's a very strong premise. The reality of evil, they say, is logically incompatible with an all-good, all-powerful God. Folks, this is the number one reason why people reject Jesus Christ. How can you call God good when you allow suffering and evil to continue? The problem we have here in the church is most Christians cannot answer this question. And believe it or not, most pastors cannot answer this question. That's sad. That means we're not being consistent with our worldview when we're told to have ready answers. The second strongest argument for atheism is, notice the word, apparent ability of scientists to explain all things in the universe without God. That's their second strongest argument. So let's get to the two worldviews. Materialism, that is the ideology that all that exists is mass and energy. There are no gods, no supernatural forces. We saw this in Carl Sagan, his statement, 1980 in Cosmos. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. That is the ideology that's being taught in many of our secular education systems today. Then the Bible. Here is our starting premise as a Christian. God does exist, and his word is true. That is, should be the starting point for all Christians. We build our entire philosophy, our entire worldview on those two beliefs right there. If you don't believe one, then you don't really have a biblical worldview. God does exist and his word is true. Genesis 1:1, it teaches God is the creator of all things. We see that as a theme throughout the entire Bible, meaning it is not a secondary doctrine. It is a primary doctrine because God called it a primary doctrine. 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is God-breathed and all of it is good for teaching, not just some of it. Now, we're going to start with the cosmological argument. The challenge, show me any evidence for the existence of God because I can't see him. Right there ends the discussion with most Christians. Because all they can say is, I believe the Bible. But you know, Muslims can say, I believe the Quran. And the other religion can say they believe their book. So that's not a good argument at all. Well, God said it's true. Well, every other religion can say the same thing about their book. So that's not a good argument. It's not going to convince anybody. So we need to be able to show some good existence for God. And I'm going to do what's called the cosmological argument. The existence of the universe. Where did it come from? There are only three real choices. Number one, the universe created itself. Number two, the universe has always existed. And number three, it had to be created. Now, some people will come up with this fourth idea. Nothing is real. That's easy to take care of. I've had people do that to me. Walk up to them, take something that's loose, like a camera off their person or their wallet or whatever, and walk away. And if they make one statement such as, I know what you're doing, give it back, they've just showed their inconsistency, haven't they? Because I'm going to say, if they ask me to give back what? It doesn't exist. See, that statement, people who say nothing's real become very inconsistent when it deals with them personally. So I don't even deal with that one. It's not even valid. But those are our three choices. Choice number one teaches the universe had a beginning. Choice number two says the universe never had a beginning. It's always been there. Choice number three says it had a beginning. So what I'm going to do is use a principle out of 2 Corinthians 10:4 and 5, who says we are told to bring down all strongholds and everything that exists against the knowledge of God. So if we can show the first two of these are inconsistent with science and logic, that leaves us only one choice, doesn't it? Unless you don't want to believe in science and logic. So let's look at the law of cause and effect. What does that mean? Well, everything that has a beginning has a cause. How many of you had a cause here? Yes, you did, or you don't exist. Every material effect must have an adequate cause that existed before the effect. That's what we mean by the law of cause and effect. Well, let's take a look at these. What's the cause here? Well, the first one's called the little brother, right? Yeah, let's blame it on them. How about the second one? How about a drop of water or something? Third one, the only thing I can come up with this, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. Something had to cause each one of these. It may not be a finger in the first one. It might be a gust of wind came up and did that, but something caused those things to fall over. Something caused those ripples in the water, and something caused this universe to come into being. Well, let's look at this. Number one, did the universe create itself? Meaning, starting point, no space, no time, no matter. We have nothing out there, zero. I'll even give this to you in another language, nada. Wow. This guy's smart, he speaks two languages. I've just given you all I know. There's two very big problems with this ideology of the universe created itself. Number one, what could cause this to happen since nothing exists? If nothing exists, there can be no source of energy for the cause. And secondly, since nothing exists, that means there's no space to pop yourself into existence. So if you think you can create yourself and nothing exists, where are you going to exist? There's no space there. And also, in order for something to create itself, that means it must have the power to act before it even exists. How can anything have power if it doesn't exist? It contradicts itself. So right there are two major scientific and logical problems for the universe creating itself. Paul Davies, makes this statement. Space-time could appear out of nothingness as a result of a quantum transition. Now, this guy's a physicist and an evolutionist. Particles can appear out of nowhere without specific causation. Yet the world of quantum mechanics routinely produces something out of nothing. You know, that convinces a lot of people because he's got degrees. Folks, I'm here to tell you cause and effect still works. It is still a law of science. Theories that the universe is a quantum fluctuation must presuppose there was something to fluctuate. And a quantum vacuum is a lot of matter-antimatter potential, not nothing. We have to start with absolutely nothing. No space, no time, no matter. See, the whole idea of a quantum fluctuation must presuppose something is there. Some source of energy must already exist, but you can't have that if nothing exists. But when you put it in his words, it sounds so scientific, and it convinces people because we're not trained to critically think. If the universe had no cause, then it can't have any properties to explain its extraordinary ability to come into existence by itself. So the whole statement by Paul Davies there is incorrect. He's done something what I call scientifically, he has bamboozled people. Don't you love scientific terms? So number one is false. Again, it is false unless you do not want to believe in science and logic. All good science says it had to have an initial cause. Let's look at the second one now. This one's a little bit harder. Maybe the universe never had a beginning. Maybe it's always existed. Well, let's look at that. If the universe always existed, then it would be an infinite number of years old. Just for your understanding, that's older than a million, billion, quadrillion years. Okay. Let's take an example here. Things wear out, don't they? Second law of thermodynamics. Wow, isn't this too late in the evening to discuss something like that? Well, let's make sure we understand. What does thermo mean? Heat. We're talking about heat dynamics. The second law of thermodynamics teaches about heat energy. Things wear out. Bananas, leave them out on the counter for a week and a half. What happens to them? They start turning really brown because the sugars are coming out. Don't throw them away because what are they good for at that point? Banana bread. Can't you just smell that coming out of the oven right now? Wow. Who's going to even listen to anything I say now? How many are thinking about banana bread? Yes. Yes. Cars wear out. Believe it or not, we wear out too, don't we? Yes. Everything material wears out, loses available energy to do good work. Now, has the universe always existed? Well, if it has, it's an infinite number of years old. What does infinity mean here? Time without end, Latin for boundless, older than a trillion years, older than a quadrillion years. That's what it means. Well, if the universe, people say the universe has always existed, does that really agree with known science and logic? Or is it just a statement? Well, I'm going to give you an example here called no refills. Anybody like any of those cars up there? In good condition, it'd all be worth a lot of money, wouldn't they? Even the one on the left. Yeah, that'd be worth a lot today if it was in good condition. Let's do this. Suppose somebody said, I'm going to give you a brand new car for free. And you get to choose any car in the world you want. Would you choose a nice sports car or convertible? You'd probably choose a convertible, wouldn't you? Yes, okay. Any car you want, and it's free. Matter of fact, everything for the lifetime for this car is free. Anything goes wrong, it's fixed for free. That's a pretty good deal, isn't it? Did you read the small print? There's some small print up there. Anybody read that? It says, all you ever get is one tank of gas, no refills. Forgot to read the small print, didn't you? No refills. So what happens after you've driven that vehicle about 300 miles? You've used up all the gasoline. In other words, you've used up all the available energy that can propel that vehicle. And once all that energy has been used up, all the gasoline has been used up, you're not allowed to refill that tank anymore. So what can you do with the car now? You can admire it. Shine it up, push it if you'd like to, or you can sell it for parts or put it in a museum, but will no longer go on its own. That's a principle of the second law of thermodynamics. That gasoline that's in there initially is the energy that can be used to drive that car. Once it's used up, it can no longer be used to do that form of work. That's the second law right there. Let's go to outer space. Stars. Stars also have a finite amount of energy. Now, what do stars do? I believe they do something called thermonuclear fusion. I put that up there because I can pronounce it and it makes me look smart. Now, what do we mean by thermonuclear fusion? It burns its lighter elements into heavier elements. Anybody know what the H stands for? Who are my chemists here? Hydrogen. Thank you. HE is the helium. See, we're getting ahead of ourselves there. Helium. C is the stuff we're made out of, carbon. O is the stuff we like to breathe, oxygen. And the last one's things we like to hit people with. Don't iron, yes. No. And once they've burned up all their available energy, most of them begin to gravitationally collapse inward, then explode into what we call a big supernova. Stars have a finite amount of energy. They're not really getting energy from any other source. Now, if the universe was eternal, had no beginning, and stars are wearing out, we know that, they're burning up their energy, after about 100 million years, most all our supergiant stars would be gone, because they tend to burn their energy a little bit faster. So there should be no supergiant stars in our universe. Stars like our sun, have enough energy for about 10 billion years. Well, if the universe had no beginning, there should be no stars like our sun out there. After about 100 billion years, most every star in this universe would be gone, and certainly after a trillion years, there should be no stars left at all if this universe had no beginning. Anybody see any stars lately? Yes. That's powerful evidence this universe had to have a beginning. Oh, wait a minute, Mike. Wait a minute. You've forgotten something very important. I learned this in school in the ninth grade. New stars are forming all the time. That's interesting. How does that happen? Well, easy. Open up an astronomy book, even your biology textbooks. We get these great big gas and dust clouds out there called nebula. And they rotate around and around and around. As they rotate around and around and around, they will begin to gravitationally collapse inward and eventually form a new star. It's right out of the textbooks. And there's actually a term for that process. It's called baloney. First of all, no one's ever seen a star form. And secondly, based on what we know about physics, that will not form. Unless you don't want to believe in science. See, here's what happens. As those clouds rotate around and around, about everything out there is rotating around, enough to get you dizzy, isn't it? They will begin to gravitationally collapse inward due to the rotation. But as they collapse inward, they generate something called heat pressure, and we can measure this. The heat pressure is always stronger than the gravity and always causes that cloud to expand outward, not inward. And also as they rotate around, they're generating magnetic field, which also pulls the cloud outward. That's why we say stars do not form by naturalistic processes. But yet in our textbooks, they're teaching a fantasy there to protect evolutionism. That's not good science, folks. That's bad science. That's misleading science. You see, it's not the creationists who are afraid of science. We want all the scientific evidence taught. We don't want fanciful stories in there. Jason Lyle, PhD astrophysics. Star formation is problematic at best. Gas is very resistant to being compressed. However, in a typical nebula, the gas pressure far exceeds the minuscule force of gravity. John Hartnett, PhD in physics. Without something else, the outward pressure due to kinetic energy of the gas molecules in the cloud is so much greater than the inward pressure due to the mutual gravitational attraction of the cloud that the resulting net outward pressure would cause the gas cloud to disperse rather than collapse. Charles Lattet and Frank Shu, both astronomers. Despite numerous efforts, we have yet to directly observe the process of stellar formation. The origin of stars represents one of the fundamental unsolved properties of contemporary astrophysics. And finally, here's a new one. Ed Churchill, PhD in astrophysics, also an evolutionist. One of the most durable problems in all of astrophysics is how stars are formed. Since the time of Laplace, a French astronomer and mathematician, astronomers have postulated numerous scenarios, but to the present, this problem has resisted solutions. Are we getting the idea here? Something's wrong with our education system? And finally, Alan Abraham here from Harvard Center for Astrophysics. Harvard's got to be right. The truth is, we don't understand star formation at a fundamental level. We need to get true science back to our classrooms. First idea, the universe created itself does not agree with any science and logic. The universe has always existed, does not agree with science and logic. That leaves us one possibility. The universe had to be created. So let's look at a summary so far. The universe can be shown to have had a beginning based on the second law of thermodynamics. The universe therefore requires a cause more powerful than itself. Oh, but wait a minute, Mike. Who made God? Ooh. What are we going to do about that one? Who made him? Well, let's look at that. From a biblical viewpoint, and God said unto Moses, I am that I am. In Revelation, I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. In other words, God tells us he's a self-existing eternal being, no beginning and no end. Well, that might be okay for Christians, but what about the non-believers? So who made God? Well, we got two possibilities. We got aggression of God back to an all-powerful God. So who made God? Well, a more powerful God made that God. Who made that powerful God? A powerful, powerful, powerful God made that powerful God. Who made the powerful, powerful, powerful God? A powerful, 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 powerful God made that one. And you go back and back. You know there's a religion that does believe that. Or one God who created everything. There's two choices. How about we invoke this, the principle of Occam's razor, which basically teaches when you got more than one possibility, let's just take the simplest one, one with the least assumptions. And what's that one? Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there's none else. I am God and there's none like me. What does the Bible teach? There's one God and only one God. And he's the creator of all things. So when we look at the conclusion here, the Bible teaches that God is the creator of space, time, and matter. Since God had no beginning, he does not need a cause. Remember, everything that has a beginning needs a cause. But since God had no beginning, he does not need a cause. In addition, since he's non-material, he's not governed by the laws of science, such as thermodynamics. See, the only possible answer that agrees with the laws of science and logic is that this universe had to be created. C.S. Evans, PhD in philosophy. Can we trust anybody that has a degree in philosophy? You betcha, we have one of them right here. Go ahead and raise your hand. Yeah, make sure everybody sees you. PhD, what is it, philosophy of religion? And he's a six-day creationist, believes the Bible. So yes, they do exist. And he is available for speaking. C.S. Evans. Belief in God is generally coherent with all we know about ourselves and our universe. It contradicts no known facts, and it makes sense of many things that would otherwise be inexplicable. Wow, I didn't know philosophers could speak so directly. sorry. So when we look at the universe, where did it come from? We have powerful evidence for the existence of God. And we can say where God came from because it agrees with known science. He's non-material, had no beginning, therefore does not need a cause. I'd like to go into the second one because this is the one that keeps people from accepting Jesus Christ. Do absolute standards really exist? Is there really a right and wrong? And how do we know? Where do our morals come from? Or are they just arbitrary? Here's the type of challenges. Where was God on September 11th? You know what? He was there. He knew that was going to happen long before it happened. Where's God when natural disasters strike? He's there. There's too much evil in the world, therefore there cannot be a God. Those are challenges. As Christians, We have to know how to answer these to bring down that stronghold. Here's a teacher's edition, sixth grade social studies text. Stress that whether a specific action is right or wrong depends on the meaning that a given group attaches to the action. That's what they teach in our schools today. There is no such thing as right and wrong. It depends on what you want it to be. Dr. Sidney Simon, co-founder of Values Clarification. A child comes to school with his values in a state of confusion. And since the parents and the church have contributed to that state of confusion, the school must help the child clarify his own values. This is what they teach in many of our public schools today. Sometimes it's not so overt, but it happens very subtly. And most parents never see the type of questions our students are getting. That's why they don't want parents in the schools so much. Absolutes versus moral relativism. Paul Copeland, PhD in philosophy of religion. There's one of our kind back there too. Wow. Here's another one believes. Moral relativism rejects any abiding moral values for all, maintaining that there is no objective ethical right and wrong, and that morality is an individual or cultural matter, none more binding than another. The day after 9/11, they were teaching in some of our universities that it was our fault. That was the very day after that happened. In some of our universities, it was being taught that way. Many of our history textbooks now teach America as the bad nation. That's why you see what's happening out there today. Let me give you an idea. I talked with an exchange student the other day, 16 years old from Spain. 16. She knew more American history than I've seen any of our high school graduates know. And she's from Spain. She could tell me almost everything that happened in World War II. Our students don't even know who we fought in World War II. I'm talking about many of our Christian students also. They can't tell you anything about the battles. She could tell me everything about the battles. She told me, and I know this, but she told me, most people don't even know this, in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, remember that one? We came one vote away from nuclear holocaust, and it was a Russian who made the vote no. One vote away from nuclear holocaust. She knew that. Our students don't know that stuff because we don't teach much history these days. It's a different history. So why should we know this subject? Lack of an answer provides a reason why non-believers are able to justify they don't believe in God of the Bible. Most Christians are not able to answer this challenge. How can you call God good when he allows evil to exist? Feelings about this subject can be very strong. And students, when confronted with this argument, are not prepared to lose confidence in the Bible. Because it's not being taught in most churches. Effects of moral relativism. Let me show you some of the effects of this moral relativism. No such thing as right or wrong. Abortion is the outcome of moral relativism. Embryonic stem cell research, which is abortion, is an outcome, and they don't work. Thought I'd let you know. Pornography, homosexual behavior, Hollywood movies are all the outcomes of a society that believes in moral relativism. No such thing as right or wrong. It's up to the individual. What about the Ten Commandments? Haven't they been banned from public view? Because they give what? Absolutes. So they've been banned. See, that's the result of moral relativism. That's the root of this. James Irwin, chaplain, U.S. Air Force. The problem of evil is one of the most crucial protests raised by unbelievers against the fact of God. That goes all the way back to 1977, and yet the church still has not been teaching this subject. Neither have many of our Christian universities. Ed Leroy Miller, 1972. The theologian's inability to supply the skeptic with a straightforward and satisfying answer to this challenge has made evil no doubt the biggest single stumbling block to belief in God of love. That was back in 1972. 40 years since then, we still haven't learned our lesson in the church, have we? we have a problem in Christian education in this country. We forgot to teach. We're turning out people with degrees who cannot defend their faith. Steve Coomer, Christianity for Skeptics, commercial. We have that book out there. You will get it. It's not a heavy-duty book. Gives you many great answers, how to answer these kind of questions. And it's got color pictures in it. Wow. So make sure you get that one. God created human beings with the potential, notice that word, the potential and the capacity to choose good or evil. He created the possibility of evil, but not its reality. Thus, God is not the author of evil. In essence, sin is the abuse of free will, the misuse of what is good. In other words, to come back and say, did God create evil? No, he did not. He allowed for the capacity of it, but he's not the creator of it. When Adam freely chose to disobey God, evil came into the world. And all of creation became corrupt. Well, let's start to answer this question. The God of the Bible is evil because he slaughters whole nations, including women and children. How can you call him good? Bertrand Russell, anybody remember that name? Confirmed atheist, Nobel Prize winner. No one can sit at the bedside of a dying child and still believe in God. There are some logical problems with that statement. Don't let anybody get away with that. Number one, since he doesn't believe in God, how can he blame God? It's a logical inconsistency right there. If God does exist, why do you think he should stop all the suffering? Who made you God? And finally, should he then prevent you from doing anything wrong? Take away all your free will? Boy, that really hits at the heart of the matter. See, his statement is logically inconsistent with what he really believes. The popular atheist argument, there is evil in the world, evil is incompatible with God, therefore God does not exist. Response, the skeptics are assuming evil is incompatible with God. See, evil has more to do with his character, not his existence, so it's an incorrect statement right there. The skeptics must prove their assumption, and it's logically possible God has a good reason for allowing evil to continue. And you find that right out of the book of Matthew. You see, one of the things we have to learn to do is focus on their words and hold them accountable for their statements. So how do we answer the non-believer? First of all, when the non-believer says there's evil in the world and that's incompatible with God, therefore God does not exist, we must understand the nature of the challenge. That's number one. Understand the nature of the challenge. Number two, we need to challenge the non-believer why they believe their statement is true. Before we even give an answer, let's challenge them back. Didn't somebody in the Bible do that once? Gee, I think their name was Jesus. When he was challenged, he asked them a question. And he said, if you can't answer my question, then I don't have to answer yours. And finally, don't leave it void. Provide a solution. Let's go through these. Understanding the nature of the challenge. How can you call God good when he allows evil to exist? The challenge here is a conclusion based on some value or standard or some objective statement of what is good and what is not good. So they're making a claim that God is evil. We need to find out from them, what do you mean by what is good or what is evil? How do you decide right from wrong? If God created us, does he not have the right to set the standards and the rules then? If he's the creator of all things, that's true, if he does that. In other words, if he's not the creator, this is the statement we have left. If there is no creator God, folks, then who's ever in power makes the rules. Does this not sound like America today? Once we leave our belief in a creator God, where many churches are today, then who's ever in power makes the rules. Those are the two choices we have. If God created us, he sets the rules. But if he didn't, it's power that makes the rules. The existence of moral absolute. Isaiah 45, verse 19. I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I did not say to the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right. The Bible teaches God states what is right and what is wrong, not man. So the nature of the challenge is, if you're going to say God is evil, I'd like to know what is the difference between good and evil. Part two, challenge them. What is your absolute standard for measuring what is good and what is evil? I'd like to know an objective statement there. I don't want a subjective one. I want an objective one. Right and wrong. Well, the non-believer really only has four possible responses. There are varieties within each one of these for existence. It's my personal opinion. That could also be said, we're just made up of chemicals. What benefits society could be an answer. The laws of society or feelings. I'm going to go through each one of these. These are the only four possible choices we have. I was brought into a discussion. There was an atheist in the area, and this man was going in and just destroying Christians with statements like this. So I got brought in, and we had a little discussion. At first, it was not a very friendly discussion because he was screaming and hollering at me. And I don't do that. I just let him get it out of their system. And every once in a while, he'd take a breath, and I'd ask him a question, and he couldn't answer it. Finally, he just said, God's evil. And I'm going to show you the exact order this discussion went in. I told my wife this is what he's going to do. And it went word for word. So, number one, he said, it's a moral code. It's based upon personal opinion. Well, if the moral code for society is based on moral opinion, then how can we condemn murderers, rapists, and burglars? Don't they have personal opinions? It is my personal opinion, your wallet belongs to me and everything in it. So you can't condemn me. In other words, there should be nobody in prison. And he saw that was not very consistent with what he wanted to believe. It was inconsistent with what he had there. So he abandoned that idea. Then he came up and said, well, maybe it's based on what benefits society. Anybody recognize those people there? Well, we know the one on the right there, Hitler, killed millions and millions. Stalin killed even more. Anybody know the next one? Idi Amin. And how about the next one? Pol Pot. All responsible for killing millions of people. Well, what's wrong with that then? That benefited their society, didn't it? You see, if it's what benefits society, different societies have different rules and regulations. Some societies say it's okay to chop your head off if you don't believe like us. How can we call that wrong? We have no right to say it's wrong if that benefits their society. It's okay to exterminate a whole group of people because they look a certain way, because that benefits our society. How can America say that's wrong? We can't. So he backed off on that one. He saw that didn't sound very good. Then his third choice, the moral code is based on the laws of society. Well, different cultures have different laws, don't they? We've had some pretty bad laws in this country, haven't we? We've had laws in this country that condone slavery. What was wrong with that, if that was our law? So he backed off that one very quickly also. Now I knew he was down to his only possibility. And his last choice, well, it was what makes people feel good. Folks, there are people out there today, it makes them feel good to harm other people. How can we put them in prison then? Because it makes them feel good. At that point, he backed off. And he had nothing else to say. See, what I had done is broken down every one of his strongholds there, which we're commanded to do. He had nothing else to say at that point. Then, before the discussion was over, that man said this, Mike, if what you said is true, that could be the most important thing in my life. Then I gave him the homework assignment. Read the book of John. And then I said, I'm going to pray for you, and you can't stop me. See, this is how we do these things. It can be done. It takes a little practice. But a lot of the Bible takes a little practice, a little study, doesn't it? What's the most important thing we're supposed to be learning in the world? About our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. You see, the non-believer had those four options. All fall short of a universal standard. Not one of them is objective. In other words, by their own standard, who's ever in power makes the rules, doesn't work. See, in principle, the non-believer has no foundation for what they believe. We do. It's called a biblical standard. See, the paradox, God is all good, God is all powerful, evil exists. They forget the fourth premise. God has a morally and sufficient reason for the evil which exists. See, in Matthew, it tells us God's time is not here yet. He's not quite ready. He's not ready for the final harvest. And in the meantime, evil exists. But he says, at some point in time, I'm going to stop all this evil. And I'm going to finish the harvest. Because during this time while evil is existing, he's bringing more people to him. That's why evil continues to exist. But he will stop it one day. Then, part three, we provide the solution. This is the most important part of anything you're going to say to that person. God's solution. Number one, he's the creator of all things, means he sets the standards. Because his standards are higher than any individual human being. The Ten Commandments are still pretty good, aren't they? Romans 1, 19 and 20 says, no one has an excuse for not believing in him. That's part of his standard. Matthew 22, verse 37, his standard says, you will have a biblical worldview. Jesus said unto them, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy mind. That's the one most Christians seem to leave out, the mind. Heart and soul, God, mind still entrenched in the way the world thinks. Then he says this. This is a hard one, folks. You got to be perfect, or you're not going to make it. Oh, my. You know what that just said right there? Nobody's going to heaven. The Bible just said that right there, doesn't it? Because we go on there, Romans 3, 23 and 6, 23. For all have sinned, all fall short of the glory of God. Nobody's perfect. Everybody's going to hell. Nobody's going to heaven. That's his standard right there. But his standard's also John 3, 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. In other words, he said this, I know you're not perfect. I will provide the solution. No matter what you've done, my grace and mercy can cover it all. That's part of his solution right there. And he says this, there's only one way, folks. It's not through Buddha. It's not through any other way. But only through my son, Jesus Christ. That's the solution. Don't ever forget to give the gospel. That's God's solution. It is the most powerful word you'll ever give that person. Not your logic, but God's words. You see, how to answer the non-believer? Understand the nature of the challenge. It's a challenge of what is the difference between good and evil. Challenge the non-believer for why they believe their statement is true and provide the solution. It's called 1 Peter 3:15. We are commanded to have a ready defense or answer for the hope that's within us. This is how it's done. And as we get close to the end, notice I said close. I've watched these pastors. I might still have four more points. Deductions, moral absolutes. The fact of evil in no way eliminates the reality of God. It has more to do with his character than his existence. You see, that's the first wrong conclusion they're making. Because evil exists, God cannot exist. No, that's a wrong conclusion. It has to do with his character. The Bible reveals where evil on earth came from. God's creation was perfect. That's why you got to believe Genesis is literal history, 6 days. Genesis 1:31, God calls entire creation very good, meaning perfect. But this was destroyed when the first man rebelled. Now, deductions, moral absolutes. Those people who believe in moral relativism, can be shown to be very inconsistent. What happens when the moral relativist is lied to, their computer is hacked into, or a family member is harmed? They immediately become very inconsistent with their moral relativist view, don't they? They say, that's wrong! Well, why is it wrong? What's the difference between right and wrong? I thought it was up to the individual. See, they become inconsistent when it becomes personal to them. Right and the moral argument. Here's a question. We've just gone through an awful lot. This is the most rights litigious country ever in the history of the world. Everybody wants their right for this and that. Even animals are saying, people are saying animals deserve all the rights that people have. Here's the question. What is a right? You ever thought to ask that simple question? I find most people cannot even come close to answering that question. What is a right? Where do they come from, and how do you know? Three good questions to ask. You know what a right is? A right is the just power to make a moral claim on another person. There's a key word there. The most powerful, the key word there is just. If you take that word just out, what do we have for a right? It's the power to make a moral claim upon someone. In other words, if I have a gun, then I have the power to make claims over you, don't I? That's what it becomes. Or if I'm the leader of a country, I have the power to change anybody's individual rights. But the word just is the key word there. That's what a right really is. Okay, claim there's too much evil in the world, therefore there cannot be a God. If evil exists, then we're assuming there's such thing as good. Now, what I'm going to go through is a wonderful argument by Ravi Zacharias. I'm going to show you what he did. This was at a university. He went through this. A gentleman got up and made that claim. There's too much evil in the world. Therefore, there cannot be a God. Ravi's, I've kind of taken this apart. If evil exists, this is his response, then we are assuming there's such thing as good. Okay? If good exists, there must be a moral law to differentiate between good and evil. Follow this through. If you admit to a moral law, you're implying there's a moral lawgiver. This is what you're trying to disprove, the existence of God. If there's no moral lawgiver, there's no moral law. Makes sense? If there's no moral law, there is no good. If there is no good, there is no evil. Therefore, what is your challenge? Classic example from Ravi Zacharias. Just had to end with that. See, if the atheist worldview, they cannot legitimately even raise the question since they don't believe God exists, can they? How can they blame God when they don't believe it exists? See, the evidence does demand a greater God. There is a moral lawgiver. And he gives the rights for everybody. You know he gave us a right nobody can take away from us? Don't we have a preamble? And in that preamble, doesn't it talk about we have certain unalienable rights? You know what that word unalienable rights means? Can't be taken away. You know we have a right. We have a right to become a citizen of God's heaven. And no one can take that away. Isn't that a wonderful God we have? Conclusion, right where we started. No one has an excuse. In everybody's heart of hearts, they know there's a creator. Now, we have lots of good resources. You saw some from Hines there. Here's one. I'll be doing this Sunday morning, a very brief one on this. Discernment, a lost art. I'm going to talk about the days of creation. What does it mean? Is it important to even believe that? What are they teaching in our schools? What are they not teaching? And it might even end with a little story about David and Goliath like you've never heard. Armies and nurseries. Our American foundation, it was formed on biblical principles. What's our current situation? How did we lose the education system? And what we can do to help win it back. When I say win it back, I'm talking about our youth. We're losing them. Over 70% of our Christian youth are walking away from the church today. How can we stop that? We have apologetics DVDs back there. Who did Cain marry? What about carbon 14? I can take carbon 14 and explain it to a sixth grader and they can understand it. Don't have to be rocket science. Here's a great apologetics book to start with. This is for the layperson who wants to start understanding what we call presuppositional apologetics. Jay Lucas, first half of the book, he gives you just the background information in this apologetics. Second half of the book, he goes through simulated conversations so you can see how it's actually done. It comes with a CD. You can listen to them also. Wonderful book to understand some of the things we just talked about. And then if you're really serious, and one of my goals is always when I leave a church, I want somebody in that church to take up the banner and start teaching about God's creation and apologetics. That's my goal everywhere I go. I want somebody else to start teaching it so I don't have to come back, or somebody else. That way you don't have to pay people. Isn't that a wonderful idea? Grow it in your own church, then you don't have to pay them. Wow. Just feed them once in a while. Every year, once a year, we offer a 5-day Creation Apologetics Teachers College. Next year, it's going to be August 1st through the 6th. That's 2016. We just had the one in June this year. It's at the Lifeway Ridgecrest Conference Center, North Carolina. We only allow 60 people to come. This year, we had 18 different states represented. Last year, we had 22 states represented. People have never seen a course like this before. You do not come to this course to be entertained or sit around in small groups and share stories. Your entertainment's at night when you're sleep dreaming. You will come to this course and you'll spend 10 to 12 hours a day in the classroom. You'll be studying at night. And you'll have to demonstrate you've mastered this information. You'll take a written final exam, closed book, closed note. You'll do 2 presentations, 5 minutes or less, on a topic. Not 5 minutes and 1 second, because I take points off. 5 minutes, 1 second, I've had a couple of people do that, and I took a point off for going over time. You do a 1 defense presentation. We will give you the topic after you're up in front of the class, and you have 3 minutes to organize your thoughts and give a response. Not 3 minutes and 1 second. To date, we have 100% success rate. No failures. I do not educate for failure. I only educate for success. It's the way I taught when I was at Microsoft, and I've taught that way ever since. Everyone will succeed because everyone in that class is coming together as a group for everybody's success. We gel together as a team. We all work together. Most of our students are out there now teaching in their churches and communities, and some even internationally. They're able to defend what they believe. If you're interested in this, we do have a brochure back there. I'll tell you what it cost. $540. What does that cover? The 5 days of training, a 300-page manual, all your food, and all your lodging for 5 days. The food is excellent. 3 good meals a day. The lodging is not bunk beds, folks. This is like nice hotel rooms, private rooms, private bath. The lodging alone costs almost $500. We supplement the cost of this conference out of our ministry, $26,000 each year. See, the real cost is over $900, but we know that could be prohibitive to people. $540 is all we charge for that. We lose a lot of money, but we're willing to do that because we need people out there who can do this. We take college students, we've had a student all the way up to 80 years old and pass, did all the presentations and the written final exam. When you come, don't think you're not going to do this. You will succeed. I will make sure you do. Because in the back of the room, we have an outlined in red masking tape, a push-up box. Yes. So that's what we're about at Creation Training Initiative. If you want to find out something about our other courses, we have our trifold here. Tomorrow morning, starting at 8:30, you're welcome to come. Our one-day creation, basic creation training class for teens and above. $45 for adults, $25 for students. We lose money unless we get 45 students. We understand that. Because when we come, we pay our own travel, our lodging, and our food. It's the kind of ministry we are. We rely a lot on the Lord and His donations because it's all His money. Please come if you want to learn how to defend your faith. And I forgot to tell you, we feed you lunch. Yes, sounds pretty good. And we supply snacks all day long. By the end of the day, you're going to think all you did was eat and take breaks. So, Creation Training Initiative. Pick up some materials back there. We have lots of materials from three different creation groups. Make sure you get some. Christmas is just around the corner. Wonderful opportunity. Don't forget birthdays for family members. Wonderful presents to give. You want me to go ahead and open up questions, or you have something to hide?